welcome to Movies, Films, and Flicks. I am Mark Hoffmeyer, and joining me is a man who saw a scene from The Relic, became obsessed with that scene from The Relic, went into his garage, built a life-size recreation of a bathroom featured in The Relic. Then, he placed a dummy on a toilet seat, dressed up as a monster, and figured out how the monster from The Relic could sneak into a bathroom, hide in a stall, lay there until a security guard comes in, smokes marijuana, so that he can take that security guard and drag him from underneath that toilet, kill him, wash his hands, and then leave the bathroom. It's John Levingood.
Mark, it sounds like you've been working on another one of your interesting articles. And like you've just seen The Relic.
I'm in the weeds, man. I got a big post coming up for Rotten Tomatoes about creature features. So this post will be up before then, but this weekend, if you go to Rotten Tomatoes, you'll see a post I wrote about a lot of creature features, 80 years worth, 36 of them. And there's a scene in The Relic where a monster who's massive is hiding in a toilet stall.
Oh, it's the size of it, like a rhino.
Hiding in a toilet stall, and it grabs a guy by the feet and drags him. If that monster could just knock the whole thing down, there's no need for it to hide in a toilet stall.
So did it grab him by biting him?
It grabbed him.
Okay, like it reached out its claw.
Yeah.
Okay.
I shouldn't have given that away because I think I want to do an illustration of the scene.
So you just rewatched The Relic, which is like 1997? Is that right?
I don't know.
It's like 20 years old.
Yeah.
And give or take a year. And how did that hold up? Because I don't think I've seen that for at least 10 years. And the last time I saw it, I was drunk and still loved it, but I was drunk.
When I saw it in 97, I believe, I was a big fan of it. I liked the creature running on fire. And
it was the best thing ever back then, yeah.
I watched it again, and it hurt my soul. Watching creature features should never hurt your soul. But the more research I'm doing, the patterns that, like, I don't want to give anything away, but the patterns from The Relic, it wants to be like the classics where you show them later, show it less. But there's no reason to do that. And it's just a silly riff off Aliens. I mean, it's just a riff off everything.
So
I didn't like it.
Do you think that they were also indirectly copying the movie Man's Best Friend with Ali Sheedy from a few years earlier?
I don't think they indirectly copied anything. I think they directly copied.
Because that dog had like the DNA of a python, and then it swallows a cat whole by unhinging its jaw, and it had the DNA of, I don't know, like a jaguar, and you saw it like retract out its claws to climb the tree to get the cat. It had like the DNA of all these things, and I'm just thinking that was basically The Relic, because they're like, oh yeah, it has 3% gecko DNA and 14% dung beetle DNA or rhinoceros beetle or something, and it's like. It just seems to me that The Relic is Man's Best Friend with an Aztec monster. Forgive me, it might not be Aztec. I'm just saying random crap in the basement of a museum.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's Man's Best Friend. Now I want to watch Man's Best Friend and The Relic. Oh my God, that's a podcast.
Please don't make me do it.
I will buy the movies for you as a gift and send them to you if you want to do. If you are willing to do Man's Best Friend and The Relic, I'll buy them. So the discussion can stop. We'll see what happens at our break. Maybe I can convince Mark.
You know what, man? I'm a good friend. And movies, films, there's no Mark in movies, films, and flicks. And there isn't an us either. But there is a, let's see, what?
There's an I.
There's an I. But then there is, let's see, oh gosh. But, you know, there is
an ampersand.
Yeah, and there's no four. I mean, movies, films, and flicks is not one person. So if you're passionate about this, I will podcast about it.
I'm going to see how I feel after my beers in this podcast and see if it's worth pushing for.
There's no I in Mark.
Nor John.
Exactly. See?
But there are vowels, and that's what brings us together.
If we were Jeopardy, R-S-T-L-N-E. Wait, no. What are the... Are those the ones that pop up, R-S-T-L-N-E in Jeopardy?
I don't know. Oh, you mean Wheel of Fortune?
Yeah, Wheel of Fortune.
Where's Wheel of Fortune? That was extra confusing for a minute. I thought Jeff Goldblum was playing.
Just thinking about The Relic has just churned my brain.
It really was. At the time, though, it really was such a special movie. I reflect on it very kindly, but I haven't seen it sober in over 10 years.
It is boring. It's boring. Lake Placid, not boring. Deep Rising, not boring. Deep Blue Sea, not boring. The Relic, boring. The Faculty, not boring. I have been watching a lot of movies, John.
It does seem a little misleading to call something The Relic when really it's just like a relic in the beginning of a movie and then all the rest of the time it's a mutant monster.
Caused by The Relic.
I mean, it really seems like they should have called it The Relic Monster.
Relication.
The Relicator! It's like one of those 80s hair metal bands that didn't make it past one hit.
Mutant Monster! Yeah! They toured with Styx for like 3 weeks, and Styx was like, these guys suck. They're a relic. No, the Relicators were a hair metal band in the 90s when grunge took over, and everyone's like, screw these guys.
I thought there was a Relegators.
Well, there's a Regulator by Warren G. I used to love that song, dude. MTV? Oh, man. I could sing that right now, but I won't. We should probably get started with the podcast.
Yeah, we probably have some listener questions on somewhere to save us from this.
In the words of John Lazavath, who I actually talked to about this movie that we're going to be talking about, and he told me to talk about a couple things in his honor, I think we have some listener questions. And I was the guy who collected the questions. And they were all, except for one majorly awesome one after the break, all of them are focused on the movie that we're talking about this week, which is Ready Player One.
Right? Just came out a week ago.
Friday. It came out in 1988.
That's right. At the time, it was probably much more innovative.
Yeah. All right. So the first question is from Chris. And Chris asks, what five characters would you add to the Ready Player One world?
So this is both really easy and really hard for me. Like, I basically found myself just thinking of neat avatars I'd like to see walking around. But for it to matter, I guess they'd have to have, like, some kind of a bit. You know, they'd have to have, you know, a little more on screen time than them just walking by, which happens with hundreds of pop culture characters. So for me, I'm just kind of digging deep into things that are fun for me. I'm going with Tim Curry's Darkness from Legend.
Ooh, that would look awesome.
Right? He's probably walking down like a down a walkway filled with random Street Fighter II characters and everything with BB-8 rolling right next to him being adorable.
Ooh, that'd be adorable. Yep.
And they're buddies. Don't ask me why, but they're buddies. They are close. And then you might have Gizmo on Darkness's shoulder.
Oh my god. You have me so conflicted.
Following with cutes, right? Mm-hmm.
I would look around the corner, see him, and be like, ah! Then I would look down and see BB and go, ooh. Then I would look back up and see him and go, ah! And then I would see adorable Gizmo on his shoulder and go, aw.
And then somehow in the background, Indiana Jones is just fumbling his way through not getting his ass kicked against Neo from The Matrix. Was Neo from The Matrix in it? Because I didn't see it.
I don't think so.
Okay, yeah.
Would Neo and Indiana Jones fight?
Well, no, because they're just random characters. They might be competing for something. They're just like avatars.
Could Indiana Jones shoot Neo or Carrie Ann Moss? What was her name? Trinity. With a bullet, or would they dodge it?
Well, I don't know. Like, did they just zero out and have to respawn and lose all their powers? Then maybe.
Well, so you got Gizmo, Tim Curry, BB-8, Neo, and Indiana Jones.
Yep.
I would lose my mind.
Yep.
All right. So for me, dude, I put a lot of thought into this. So my first one would be the horse from Neverending Story, Artax.
Oh, yeah.
Because that dude dies.
Is he covered in mud when he walks around as an avatar?
Don't make me cry, dude. And it's like, we know he lives at the end of Neverending Story, but just to see him running through again would just make me so happy. I'm like, he's there. He's alive.
They're playing the song, Turn Around. It's such a wonderful song.
What a horrible moment in a PG film. what a terrifying moment.
There were a lot of scary things. But so that wolf that seemed to be modeled after the Fenris wolf from Norse mythology, I guess, that was either the darkness or he was the predecessor of the darkness. But that wolf was terrifying.
How big was that wolf?
He was not wolf-sized. He was like... He was bigger than direwolf size, I think.
Oh, wow. So he was excessive.
The rock biter was terrified of it.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, all that whole team of, like, weird characters were all terrified. Like, if the rock biter is terrified of it, and he's, like, 30 feet tall and made of rock.
Yeah. So
think about that. If you're 30 feet tall, you are, like, as heavy as a Jaeger. You're made of rock. And you bonk a wolf on the head, and you're still scared of it. That's a big wolf. That's big, scary, evil wolf.
That's a big... I don't got him in this movie, but I got Artax.
It must be the bastard son of Loki.
Ooh. I read Norse mythology from Neil Gaiman, the book he released last year, and it was amazing. So if you love Norse mythology, and you like Neil Gaiman, who is amazing, buy the book. We don't get any money for this. I should have waited until we could get money for it. But yeah, do that. All right, so my second one is Fezzik from The Princess Bride.
Good, good, good.
I just love Andre the Giant.
Yep. Does anybody want a peanut?
And I think he's amazing in that movie. And I love I read the book. I'm dropping books. The book that Cary Elwes wrote about the making of Princess Bride. He's just such a charmer, Andre the Giant. And in this movie, he's just like just so likable. He's just I love him. And I would just like to see him. He would have to be all CGI, which is kind of weird. But if I just saw him in the background bonking somebody on the head, it would be so happy.
Right now, I feel like I'm in a 1990s car insurance ad, and I see dollar signs with wings flying away. Every time you mention books, you need to reach out to these people in social media before we do this.
And speaking of, and Ready Player One. And then next we have Ernest P. Worrell.
Is he the Ernest from any particular movie, or for our audience's sake, does it not matter?
It doesn't matter. No. Remember in How Did This Get Made, how June and the other hosts were in love with Evil Ernest?
Ernest Goes to Jail?
Yeah, I want Evil Ernest, I want Ernest, and I want Old Lady Ernest fighting people.
Are you is that three choices?
No, that's one. Oh, okay. If I just stick with one, it'd be regular Ernest. And also, I read a book called Keeper of the Clown, My Life with Jim Varney, where director John Cherry wrote about his commercial work with Jim and all the movies. It's a very good book if you're interested in reading about Ernest and Jim Varney's path. Also, Jim Varney's nephew wrote a book about Jim Varney, and I've read both of them. So if you go online, look up Jim Varney books, and you're interested in learning about how Ernest got made and how it got started and about his life, you should. John Cherry's book is especially interesting because they were huge in advertising back in the day. And then it led into a deal with Disney, which is pretty incredible. So I've heard this people oil. All right, I'm moving on.
I think you should be allowed to pick all three of those Ernest characters, though. Like, it's a good ensemble. Like, you should be able to say the Hogwarts faculty if you really wanted to.
Yeah, that's true.
You should be able to say House Hufflepuff.
Ooh.
Like, if you wanted to. So if it's an ensemble, I think it's cool.
Next, the Queen Alien.
Oh, I'm actually kind of surprised we didn't see something like that.
I want the Queen Alien running amok. I want the good guys to, like, unleash the Queen Alien bomb like they did with Chucky. And the Queen Alien just lights up everybody from IOI and just destroys people. Because if you think about it, we've seen the Queen Alien do some cool stuff, like in Aliens, but obviously it wouldn't be animatronic, so there would be a CGI Queen Alien. So that thing
like
would
AVP.
That thing would destroy people, and it'd be Spielberg's. So it would be incredible.
Okay, so that wouldn't be an avatar. That would be a part of the game.
Yeah. I think I have the one that's going to win everything. Because this is my favorite monster in the history of monsters, and it's the Rancor.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the troll from Ernest Scared Stupid.
I didn't want to double up on Ernest.
Okay.
I want the Rancor. Just because it's one of my favorite visual effect or practical effects ever made. And just to see it running, like just knocking people out of the way and just destroying tanks and just eating people and being amazing. Just to have I want to see the Rancor. You know how the T-Rex gets that big old roar, like that big, when it gets to yell or whatever, roar, whatever T-Rexes do.
cluck.
I want the Rancor to just flex, close its fist, and just go, like, oh my gosh, that'd be so cool. So those are my five.
That's a fun ensemble.
I mean, I love this list. I was writing it down. I was dancing. I was like Timothy. I was like Timothy Oliphant in the Santa Clarita Diet, where he tells a lie and says he was teaching someone a dance lesson, and then later on, these people ask him to teach him how to dance. And
oh, that reminds me, I got to get on season two.
That's a really well written show. I like that show. But yeah, so that's my five. The next one is from Will, and they ask, "What horror movie would you put in Ready Player One?"
So I'm assuming he means like the major set piece backdrop, like they did with The Shining.
So if there's Ready Player One, Two, and you have to pick a horror film, which horror film? So I guess the scene is they have to go into this world and they have to like navigate it through all the scary crap to get a key, which we'll explain later. But what horror film would you pick? And can you let me try to guess it?
You can try and guess it.
And you can try to guess mine.
Okay.
Would you pick Event Horizon?
It wasn't one of my top picks, but it had crossed my mind because we had podcasted about that several episodes back. Yeah, it's that just struck me though. Like that's such a great like playing field for horror, but it's so out there. I almost feel like it wouldn't fit, almost like a Saw movie.
You couldn't get a PG-13 with the Event Horizon world.
I mean, they pulled it off with The Shining, though. They did pull it off with The Shining better than I thought they would. But I don't know. And now that you actually said it, I almost want to say AVP. Now I almost want to just totally change what I was going to say, but I was going to go Resident Evil 1.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good
pick. The first Resident Evil movie. Yeah. When they're in that, they're basically escaping the mechanized research center of Raccoon City, or I mean, below Raccoon City. And, you know, it had like the laser grid that just grid chops the guy up. It had, you know, like it was treating all the occupants like they were a virus to be solved. And so the White Queen or Red Queen, I always get it mixed up, was trying to just kill them all. Ooh. I see something like that.
That'd be fun, having to navigate levels.
Yeah, and then they're the weird dogs. They're the weird zombie Umbrella Raccoon City dogs.
And then it'd be fun to watch all the zombies chasing around the people and just seeing people getting wiped out by zombies.
Fighting the dogs. Like, I like to see H just like one of those dogs jumps at it and everyone else is like, ah! And H is just like thud. Like the thunk, splattered dog.
I like this. I see it in my head though. That's the thing. You picked a good one.
But AVP would be fun in a different, well, more for just the alien fans though, right? Because if you actually had the face huggers and stuff going around and infecting people, but I feel like that could get out of hand.
Yeah, because that's like that's a long. What if they just got caught in the middle of a battle between the two?
Yeah, it's like an apocalypse scenario.
Ooh. I wouldn't pick the relic.
I mean, I don't know how menacing that monster would be against the avatars of this world, though. Because, like, that monster was devastatingly powerful against an ill-trained security guard and some scientists. Like,
yeah, just don't go in the bathroom.
I mean, but it was just terrifying to totally regular people.
All right. So what movie do you think I picked?
Not The Ritual.
And do you need a hint?
Do you want, I do. I definitely need a hint, actually.
Cardigans.
Deep Blue Sea. Oh, I
Cardigans.
I still know what you did last summer.
Lipstick.
Oh, dear.
Elise.
Oh, you want to drop them in Insidious. And with the further, that's a good call.
I just want more of the red lipstick demon, the angry lady. I want more of the man who knocks. I want whoever the villain was in the fourth one that I already forgot. The Keymaster?
Just the Keymaster or something. We didn't know his motive. I didn't like that. Yeah, he was really creepy looking.
It's funny how I rattle off the first three. Then the one that I've seen most recently, I'm like, I don't remember. But I mean, I just think that'd be cool. Just the first further, just the practical effects, getting lost, getting driven deeper into it with the different doors, and getting that crazy red lipstick demon lair going through that school home with that crazy villain from the second one, the third one, that weird dude who can't breathe, just wandering around making people not breathe. I just, I just think that's a cool horror world to enter.
I think so too, and it doesn't necessarily. have to push the terror envelope. It can just be the mysticism of the further at times. There can just be a rampant, you know, just weird gangly demon bouncing around when you want one to scare H, because H just wanders into everything.
Yeah. H was legit. Why did H do all that?
Get lost?
Yeah.
But I guess we're going to talk about it later, but H just did, well, because H didn't know the movie he was in.
Oh, she was in. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. Doesn't like scary movies.
Good call. So you got Resident Evil. I have Insidious. I think either one of those would be really fun.
Yeah. So, but the first Resident Evil, before it was like monsters all over the place.
The first one had me pretty on the edge of my seat, the first Resident Evil.
Well, especially back when it came out.
Yeah, I dug that movie. I tried to play that game on GameCube, and I played it for 30 minutes. I turned it off and just started playing Mario Kart.
That movie held up a lot better than I expected, because last year I watched all of them, and part one, actually parts one through four, all held up way better than I expected.
You know what's weird for me is I like one, and I'm not too into two, three, and four, but I like the last ones because they're just stupid.
Yeah, four was when it started to really go into bonkers town with the story. You know, they really tried hard to keep developing that story. Like, they kept adding elements, and pretty soon there were the Alice clone, like, S&M ninjas running around, and, like, in their weird leather stuff that no one can do jump kicks in.
Yeah.
You'd be so rich. Like, you would be walking like Ralphie's brother in A Christmas Story when he was wearing three winter coats over each other, like, just all stiff-limbed.
Yeah, there'd be no spin kicks.
Nope, you just fall. I mean, you'd spin a little bit and you just topple over.
Yeah, that's I would never fight zombies in that outfit.
Nope. I mean, you'd be rather bite-proof.
Yeah, you're right.
If you were wearing three winter coats over one another and three pairs of mittens,
I would just, if I was the bad guys, I would turn up the heat.
That's right. Just we're gonna wait him out. I don't know what zombies talk like. This is...
Oh yeah. All right, you want to move on to the main topic?
Let's do it.
Ready? Are you ready for it? Boom,
boom, boom. Ready Player One!
What'd you think?
So this movie, my overall statement about that, God forbid someone hasn't seen this movie before listening to us, which I would consider a mistake. You should probably, like, stop this, save it on your desktop, and go watch the movie,
spoilers,
and then come back and play it.
Spoilers, spoilers.
Yeah. We're going to spoiler it all. We're going to spoil it all. Spoiler it all. But I left, so on the downside, even though I didn't walk out with a negative attitude at all, I wasn't impressed with the story. It was very basic. I wasn't necessarily impressed with the character development. It was very basic. But the characters are what made this movie. This was 100% full throttle character driven for me, with a little bit of wonderful emotional catharsis at the very end. But it was just about characters and being friends and going through this world that we're being introduced to. And I thought all the characters were awesome. And this was a nostalgia bomb. I read an article that basically said, like, here's a whole lot of nostalgia with a whole lot of nostalgia piled over it, with a whole lot of nostalgia in the background, and they're running over a whole lot of nostalgia. And if you don't find a lot of story, that's okay, because you'll never notice that because of all the nostalgia that you are loving.
When I walked out of the movie, this is going to sound like a really weird comparison, but I went and watched Pacific Rim 2 last week with Megan, and when we walked out, we had a big conversation about it comparing to the first one, had some long talks about it, really kind of broke down Pacific Rim 2. But when we walked out of Ready Player One, we had big smiles on our face. But then we're like, hey, you want to go get a beer? She's like, yeah. And we just kind of went about our day. It was weird. I don't want that to seem like it's a slight on the movie. I just watched it, enjoyed it, and then I forgot about it until I started taking notes again for this podcast.
I mean, it is it's a nostalgia-gasm. If you are a child of the 80s or the 90s, this is just filled. You just enjoy, even when characters are just walking by in a walkway, and you just see, like, and you got to realize you're missing 9/10 of it. You're like, oh, there's Chun-Li. Oh, there's Freddy. They just shot Freddy. Freddy was on the screen, Freddy Krueger, for like a second and a half. And you're like, oh, there's so-and-so. Oh, there's Ryu. Oh, there's Battletoads from the 80s Nintendo game in the cartoon. I saw Battletoads in more than one scene. And you're like, oh, a Ninja Turtle. It's so fun. It's, you're like a 7-year-old, just pointing at things and saying what you see and being excited.
Yeah, when I, when at the ends, when, what's his name, Ty Sheridan, the main character's name.
Oh, Percival.
Yeah, Percival. When he lifts up the boombox, like, and say anything from Loin Dobbler, I was like, yeah! And then when the Firefly spaceship shows up, I was like, ah! When the holy hand grenade got used, I was like, oh my gosh! When Goro popped up, I'm like, he's so much cooler than in the movie. Like,
and then a chestburster came out of Goro.
Yeah, I was like, oh my gosh! So it's what I loved it. And I do think, it lagged a little bit in the middle. I don't know why I thought that. I don't think it was bad, but I just kind of lost a little bit of interest and just invested more thought into my popcorn. But when everything sort of kicked off, and you know me, man, I'm into really thoughtful movies. I'm not saying I need action at all times, but I really just enjoyed the nostalgia blasts in my face. And even though there weren't too many like real world stakes, a couple from like a really bonkers moments. I guess I just like seeing the big shiny stuff play in front of the Easter eggs. Iron Giant, the last action hero, 3, Jack Slater 3 on a billboard in the background. I thought that was pretty cool. Seeing Jason and Freddy.
I mean, and then of course there was the, I won't call it, why can't I think of the word? It wasn't like an acme. It wasn't a crescendo. What's the word? I can't even think of the term in this storytelling. But either way, it wasn't like the middle of the film. It wasn't a big reveal per se. But when we see Mecha Godzilla as one of the items that our excellent bad guy had, I was just so tickled pink. And again, because it wasn't the Avatar, it was the item that the IOI company bought, that it had the abilities, which is why in the listener question I brought up, oh, that's in the game. That's not an avatar, because the avatars are limited by the things they get, but the game can just be like, here is Mechagodzilla.
So do you want to break down this movie real quick for us? Do you kind of want to let, I know everyone's probably watched this, but what's the basic rundown of it? Like, how would you, what's your elevator pitch for it?
We have a world scale RPG where everyone in the world seems to play this game. You can accumulate things of value in the game that translate into things of value in the real world. And as a result, everybody in this rather dysphoric future are particularly invested in this game. In this game, your avatar can be anything.
Love it.
I didn't really do a good job. I just listed things.
And
I
then
was totally.
The creator of it is like, hey, if you find 3 keys, you will have control of this entire world. So a company called IOI, which is, I wrote it down here somewhere, Innovative Online Industries, led by Ben Mendelsohn's Nolan Sorrento, they pay tons of people to play this game to get the keys. And if you owe money to this company, you have to go work for them to find the keys.
Yeah, they made it into like an indentured servitude.
Yeah, and then you have the hero Percival and his crew of Artemis, played by Olivia Cooke, and his other teammates, and they go to get the keys, and the first challenge is a race, the second challenge is the Shining, the third challenge is a video game called Adventure.
Which I don't remember, by the way. It might have even predated my interest in games.
I remember playing an Atari, but I had a Nintendo. I think I had no, I had a Sega Genesis. I had friends that had Nintendo.
Like, I had played Pitfall and a couple other things like that, but very briefly before Nintendo came out.
So, you know what made me most happy about this movie is Spielberg directed it. So many people I feel like have ripped off Spielberg. You got J.J. Abrams doing Super 8. You have, I mean, not ripped off, but you know what I mean. Stranger Things. You have all these movies that play on the nostalgia of Spielberg and tell movies like Spielberg. So I'm really happy that Spielberg was able to tell a nostalgia-esque film.
He got to give us a fan film, and it was the fan film that I'm not criticizing for being a fan film.
And you know what I liked is, he told them not to add any of his movies in, but the production crew kept trying to hide movies that he either directed or produced in the background. And he actually caught a gremlin in the background of one of the shots. He's like, well, it's too late to take it out. So they snuck one in. they tried to like throw in like little Easter eggs about Spielberg movies, and they kept catching them and throwing them out. I thought that was pretty funny.
Well, there was the T-Rex.
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty sweet. What'd you think about the hero? What'd you think about the kid, Ty Sheridan? I think he's a good actor. He's in a movie called Mud, which I think he's very good in. And he's also in Tree of Life, which I liked him a lot. What'd you think about Percival? Was he just kind of like a blank slate to base a movie on, or what'd you think about this kid?
Yeah, he was very plain, and I'm not, again, this isn't meant to be a negative criticism, but it was really just the things that he encountered and realized and learned about the world, and learned about the world's creator. The world's creator was the most pertinent character to me in this film. He had almost all the heart that we see on screen, in my opinion. But yeah, like, I mean, him in the real world, by the way, the real world of this future Columbus, Ohio, that's overpopulated in the year 2040, whatever, like, none of that ever mattered to me. What he did in the real world, never really mattered to me. And his character, again, his character just did amazing things. And they did, this was a wonderful visual and recollective journey of happiness. It really, again, the story just didn't have much to do.
Yeah. I think my
favorite. And not in a bad way. I keep saying that. It's like, it's not in a bad way.
I think this kid was given, obviously he was given a lead in a Spielberg film, but he didn't get a chance to really show any acting chops, I guess, in it. He's good, he's likable, and he gets exactly what the script needs, but I think the script just needed to get to the big set pieces and the nostalgia and those kind of things.
In all of the best emotional moments that he has, for the most part, are either through his character, so we don't really see the human going through that, or it's more when he's standing in front of the creator of the game, and he's seeing the creator of the game do it, but we know that he's learning, he's growing up as he sees this.
I will say my favorite thing about him is that his favorite movie is Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah, that way before his time, too.
Dude, Buckaroo, yeah, way before his time. Dude, Buckaroo Banzai, that's one of my favorite movies. I adore that film. And I was watching Santa Clarita Diet, and they, you know, no matter where you are, there you, no matter where you go, there you are. Like, they quoted that. Is Buckaroo Banzai having a renaissance?
Maybe.
Laugh while you can, monkey boy. But do you want to talk about, so the whole mission of this is to get the first key. And do you want to talk about the awesome race that like how cool that was and the things that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, so, well, I'll just start with my wonderful nerdgasm moment when we see Z get into his car. It's forming. It's almost like he throws out a little like an anime pod, if you will, and it digitizes in front of him into a DeLorean.
Yeah, dude, that was awesome. He picked the perfect car.
It was great. Yeah, and so and of course his buddy H, who's this giant mechanized creature of an avatar of a Hulk, he has like this kind of monster truck looking thing.
Yeah, and like let's talk about the race and then let's go back to Planet Doom, because I want to talk about that too. But I loved how it started off and how all those people from IOI, like the indentured servants, they weren't even trying to finish the race. I feel like they were just trying to wipe out other people.
Well, that might have been their goal. Some of them might have been there just to wipe other people out so that their lead players, or, you know, their players who had more time in since their last respawn and or more gear, better skills, so IOI equipped them better, could have the lead. Because your chances of dying and having to respawn in that race were high. I mean, King Kong is smashing you. A T-Rex is coming at you. You know, people are flying off the rails. It's death racey. Things are, you know, blockades are coming up and people are crashing into them.
Yeah, yeah. What, T-Rex, King Kong. And I like how the first time it's Artemis and Percival who make it to the end. Percival realizes that King Kong is going to get him. And then he stops Artemis. And instead of her being like, thank you, she's like, you know, sometimes you just got to make that jump. But like, if you make that jump, you're dead.
Yeah, and she would have lost a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I was like, yo, come on, Artemis. I know it plays in later in the movie.
You know, and it's interesting, too, because they basically revealed that race had been conducted tens of thousands of times. It happened every day for a couple decades.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, not tens of thousands of times. I'm sorry. It happened, maybe like 7,500 times.
Yeah, I mean, and it's kind of interesting that no one thought to go in reverse. But well, his reverse driving was still really impressive.
It's just interesting that everyone kept trying to win the race in a standard way. Like, if you have that much data in front of you, and people have to be looking at this, no one is trying to think of some weird alternative. I mean, going in reverse, yeah, I mean, I guess who the hell is ever going to think of that? But at the same time, everyone's just like, yep, go forward, knock people off the road. We got to win this race. Like, that wasn't overly logical to me. It was one of many things in this movie that were very, you know, face value.
I would have started, I would have at least gone to the very end and just kind of driven along.
Well, if everyone, if everyone is always, if no one is ever winning for 7,500 races, might you just drive 5 miles an hour?
Yeah.
But I mean, just to see everything that there was, and then you kind of drive up and you're just sitting there like looking at King Kong, who's just, you know, roaring at you, waiting for you to come. Or maybe he just smashes you, I don't know. But I mean, it strikes me that people would have been trying to come up with other things. And there are so many objects that you can have. They mentioned that there is a Millennium Falcon. They mentioned that there are these other things. Okay, I mean, I don't know the rules of this game. It seems like you have to start in a vehicle. Are you limited by what your vehicle is? Could you use the Millennium Falcon? Could you later? Could you jump where King Kong could grab you and then leap out of the vehicle? And if you landed on the other side without dying, would you win? Could you take the Millennium Falcon for 100 yards? I mean, I don't know fully the rules.
Oh my gosh.
But there's so many crazy items in this game that it strikes me that they're very logically would have been another way. I mean, it's not like King Kong is the one. He is not Neo. He doesn't get to hit you every time. He still moves like King Kong. If five people were to rocket off at the same time, I guess he could jump up and chest bump them. But feasibly, something is keeping everyone from getting there.
Do you think, you know what I was just thinking about? Do you think this is Spielberg's way of saying, like, guys, do research. Think. Hunt. Figure things out. Think outside the box. Because the one guy who thinks outside the box out of, how many trips did you say? 7,000, 13,000?
Like 75. I mean, if it was 20 years at 365 a year, that's 3,650 a decade. That's like 72. That's 7,300.
Yeah, so maybe he's just saying, guys, like, research. Maybe this is Spielberg's way of telling people, hey, guys, there's resources out there.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's like you don't have to punch your way through everything.
Man, Spielberg's a genius.
I mean, everyone was just trying to punch their way through every time.
Like, as much as I'd love to try to punch my way through a horde of zombies, it's not going to work.
Not through well, it might, Mark. We're large fellas, and zombies are slow. But we can't punch our way, even as a team, through King Kong.
Yeah.
Even in DeLoreans.
If I saw a group of zombies, I would run backwards. So maybe I would be good at this.
Okay, so by the way, Z had at some point accumulated enough coin to purchase a DeLorean. If he hits 88 miles an hour, can he time jump to 3 seconds after that ape took a swing at him and be on the other side? Oh my goodness. He fly? Because the DeLorean can. I feel like, when you purchase an item in the game, it has the characteristics it had in pop culture. Why is he just driving the DeLorean like a race car?
You're right. I have a question for you. Would you go to Planet Doom and try to fight for coin?
So can we just address Planet Doom? Because that felt like a volcanic version of Planet Klaatu. Was it Klaatu? Klendahu. Klendahu in Starship Troopers.
Yeah, it's just a terrible place.
Like, it was just a sea of death. It was a sea of colliding conflict. So yeah. I would never go there. If I was in the game, I'd never go there unless I felt like I had an in that specifically is where the key was. But I feel like I'd need a clue to take me there.
Like, I guess you go there to fight for money, but why would you go in there as Jason? You just get shot.
Whatever, maybe it's a 12-year-old who didn't think it through.
Yeah, a lot of people are getting killed and going, oh man, I would go in there, I would save up a lot of coin by like doing other things in the game, become the T-1000, get a monster gun and just light a few people up then leave the level.
I mean, sure, there were a lot of, again, not in a bad way, there were a lot of things that didn't fully add up in this game, but then again, in the movie, I mean, who are the majority of the players running these avatars in the game? They are Joe Average. They are Joe Everybody. They aren't all gaming geniuses.
Oh, yeah. They're,
like, some of these people, like, it's his abusive aunt's boyfriend who looks like someone from the Cotton Eye Joe music video. Like, you know, he looks like he's missing a chromosome and can't do his multiplication tables, but he's playing the game because he wants to get rich.
It's like Vegas.
You know, it's like, so a lot of the people playing this game might not be making the best decisions, or they're just desperate, because we did see this future world of like a stacked up three-dimensional trailer park, right? It's like, maybe they're just all these desperate people and this is their lottery ticket. And oh, maybe this time when I play, I'll win. It's not reasonable.
I got to tell you something, John. I make some horrible decisions when I'm gambling. So, I guess I can't judge anybody.
But it's just, yeah, it's, again, this is not a movie for depth of story.
Yeah. Hey, who would you choose to go to Planet Doom in battle? Who would be your character?
Oh, my character. I was going to say whoever has the Mechagodzilla token.
Oh, gosh. You could just go there and crush everybody.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, you could.
And then take all their coin.
Yes. And that's a weird thing, too. They say that when you die, you lose everything that you have. But I thought it was interesting because, contrary to most games that I'm aware of, I don't play a lot of games, though. I don't play any games. But so when Z is in the race in the beginning, and then later in the film, when someone dies and they have to respawn, all their stuff just kind of appears right there, which means that when TJ Miller's character, who when he went, he was like, oh, no, I have 10 years of stuff inside of me. And he like all this, you know, it was like millions of gold pieces and items of all sorts, like just erupted out of him. If some schlub who just respawned was right next to him, he'd have everything. And that, I felt like, was a big hole of a thing.
Are we thinking too much about this movie?
I always think too much about movies, Mark. Yeah, you're right. I always think too much about movies.
You know what's funny? I didn't think about any of this while I was watching it. I just had a big stupid grin on my face.
I had a big stupid grin, but I was noticing these things.
I did think my popcorn was a little salty.
Like, at first it was very innocent, though, right? Because when he's in the race and someone goes and a few coins appear and he's just like, oh, grabbing them, I'm putting it in front of my gas gauge, like in Minority Report, also a Steven Spielberg movie. It's like that. I dug that. That was cool. And you also have to take a minor risk and you're maneuvering on the racetrack to get those coins.
Yeah.
And so that, like, I liked that. That was in a good spirit.
Maybe that kid knew the pattern of the level already, because there seemed to have been a pattern to it. So maybe he knew it and that's why he was able to keep going through to the end.
Right, right. Yeah. And maybe a lot of the people make it that far and then King Kong gets them.
King Kong's a jerk.
He really was. Like, what if you... It couldn't be that much. It would be like 1/20th of a holy hand grenade to get a shipping container with 10,000 pounds of bananas. What if you just brought that? Like, would that work?
And I had to watch a shit ton of King Kong movies for this article I'm writing. And King Kong kind of just does his own thing. Like, he doesn't go out of his way to destroy people. He's just looking for a lady. And in this one, he just wants to wreck shop.
Yeah. But I mean, that's what the game creator just decided. For the sake of the race, though.
So is the game creator saying that King Kong is a malevolent force?
I think that he is just saying that in this game, King Kong is an obstacle, much like any other obstacle in a game.
This movie reminds me of Pixels.
A little bit. except not terrible.
Like Donkey Kong dropping the barrels down.
Like when the creator of Pac-Man is like, oh... my child, and he holds out his hand and he eats his hand and digitizes in front of him, pixelates in front of him. And like, ah!
You would have been great in the race as a Mario Kart.
I'm a little surprised we didn't see something like that.
But
at some point, I think I saw a toadstool walking around, though.
But here, like, we were given a nice Steven Spielberg Philly cheesesteak and we're complaining that it doesn't have cheese curds on the side. I don't even know what that means.
I mean, who doesn't want cheese curds?
Not with a Philly cheesesteak.
Are they fried?
I would eat, if I was in Canada, I would go to a cheese curd food van and just get cheese curds. I wouldn't get it with a sandwich.
There's one sandwich I've had with cheese curds on it that I liked in St. Pete.
With
Engine Number 9.
Oh, that makes sense because it has cheese curds.
Yeah.
Like cheese curds on fries.
No, but on the burger.
Oh, that sounds great.
Cheese curds on the burger with a slice of pork belly over the burger itself.
Did they call it an ultimate burger?
I think it was called One Bad Pig.
Oh, nice. All right, hey, so how about this? Let's take a break. Let's go eat some cheese curds, and we will be back to talk more Ready Player One.
Really? Who doesn't like cheese curds?
I love cheese curds. Welcome back to Movies, Films, and Flicks. We did not have burgers with cheese curds, but we did have some delicious beers. And John, we have a cool update for our listeners.
So many updates, other than the lack of cheese curds.
So, last week we sent a note to Creature Comforts, who make the delicious Tropicalia, Reclaimed Rye, Athena, Tropicalisma, Duende, Cosmic Debris, beautiful beer.
I was all over them for the Coco Boonie.
Yep, Coco Boonie, and you sent them a tweet, and they ended up following you and I.
Yep. It was a shameless plug.
Shameless plug, but they went with it.
But a gracious plug.
And I want them to know that I have a Tropicalia shirt, I have Tropicalia soap, which I haven't used yet, and I have Get Comfortable Socks, which is one of their beers as well. And they also have a table beer. That's very good. So, Creature Comforts, thank you for your follow. We know you're listening to our podcast.
And Mark, it is because of you that I ever got to try their Tropicalia, and you gave me a six-pack of it. I just had my last one before our last podcast when we plugged them, and then I had my Coco Boonie left.
Tropicalia is delicious.
Dude, so tasty.
It'll change your life. And that's not hyperbole.
I mean, it'll give you a minor good change in your life. By the way, please send us beer.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, though. Normally, I like to just get, like, one of each beer to kind of sample things. But if I see a six-pack of Tropicalia, I'm buying it.
Mm-hmm. I'm a whore for singletons just because I'm a whore for untapped. And I'm just trying to get my badges up. But there are certain things where I'll go through a six-pack. And I got to get more Coco Boonie. You got to send me more Coco Boonie.
I will do that. And you know what's another beer that I really enjoy is New Belgium's Fat Tire.
Good standby. Like, that is like my favorite beer that I can have almost every day.
Yeah. Whenever I'm out and I see that beer, I get a New Belgium Fat Tire.
And they were ahead of the curve. I was into them before I was into craft beer. I didn't know I was into craft beer because I was into them.
Yeah, they're one of, like, the first big craft breweries.
I go there every year, their Asheville location.
Yeah, they just built out there, didn't they? Or they always been Asheville?
They've been out there for at least 2 or 3 years. By the way, New Belgium, I'm coming in July.
Yes. So, New Belgium, we have a lot of listeners. We have a lot of blog followers. We will happily support your beer. Because I know you're making big pushes. I know you have a new kind of Fat Tire blonde that you're pushing.
And if I happen to show up in July and you happen to serve me a Movies, Films, and Flicks Imperial Milk Stout, like, that would be fine if you want to. I don't want to restrict your creativity.
I would love it if you made a Jaws IPA, an Ernest Saison, and a Deep Blue Nitro Irish Porter. We like you, New Belgium. Fat Tire, it's a good beer.
All good things.
I want to be on a boat with a Fat Tire. I want to be on a rope swing with a Fat Tire.
Even if you were besieged by deep blue sea sharks on that ship.
If I was on a pontoon boat and you called me from somewhere and you're like, Mark, what kind of beer you want? I'll be like, bro, Fat Tire.
You know, right now I'm actually having a Marshall Zukov from Cigar City. I'm quite loving it.
And I also had a Guava Grove sour ale brewed with guava.
Dude, I love that thing. I'm so happy you like it when I did not ship it to you because that would break the law.
Normally, I'm not really into sours, but I really enjoyed it. Normally, I think, you know, High Lie is my highlight of IPAs. You have Zukov on your chin. Normally, if I'm somewhere and I see High Lie on draft, I'm like, these guys know what's up. And if I see White Oak High Lie, I'm like, these guys really know what's up. And if I see Marshall Zukov, I'm like, I love these people. And if I see Hunapu on draft, I'm like, this doesn't happen.
Dude, not even a joke. When we lost my father for his memorial, of the two beers that I had on draft were Cigar City High Lie and Tampa Bay Lager.
And I bet everyone was happy.
No one complained. It wasn't Miller Lite and Miller High Life or what, I don't know what these people drank.
I would have to restrain myself because I would look really happy. Dude, that's a great selection right there, man. I love High Lion Lager.
I hope everyone is enjoying the podcast brought to you by Movies, Films, Flicks, and Craft Beer.
That's right. We like craft beer.
I love craft beer.
But we're not pretentious about it.
I am.
I understand why everyone drinks certain type of beers, and I think it's smart for craft brewers to make pilsners and lagers, because a lot of the market wants to do that. I mean, I do believe there's a like Mick Ultra and all that kind of stuff, but I guess I don't like drinking a lot of one. I like drinking a lot of, or a little bit of many.
I feel like we should write a book that has critical film reviews that are recommended films only, of films that people wouldn't think of, and we will pair them with craft beer.
All right, so how about this? If you're listening to our podcast, go to Movies, Films, and Flicks on Facebook, or go to MFF John's Horror Corner, MFF Horror Corner, or at Movies, Films, and Flicks on Twitter, and give us little-known movies. Really, give us the most random movies you can think of, and we will pair them with a beer, and we will talk about it on next week's podcast.
That would be fun. Yes!
Please, do it.
Yep. I mean, actually, do it. We joke about a lot of things. Really do it.
Yeah. And, like... We've actually started answering questions, which is kind of worrisome. But speaking of questions.
Do you have any questions that we won't really answer?
Speaking of questions, I want you to read this, because we got a humdinger from our homeboy Johnny Num. This guy is on fire. I love this guy. I feel like he just gets it in his head, and he's able to eloquently write them down. When I get something in my head, I'm like, John! And you're like, what'd you just say? But when Johnny Num gets something on his brain and wants to spit it out, he makes it sound great. He's like the freestyle, he's like the Eminem freestyle rapper of random listener questions to Movies, Films, and Flicks.
Johnny Num's palms are sweaty.
And you know, like, oh, anyway, let me tell you a joke. A guy walks into a bar owned by Eminem, right? He walks up to the bartender and he goes, hey man, give me 2 shots. And the bartender goes, stop. You only get 1 shot. You know what I'm talking about?
I know what you're talking about. You're 8-miling.
That was on Reddit. I saw that joke on Reddit. I can't take credit for it. All right, so let's get this question by Johnny Num, because I have an amazing answer.
All right, well, so this is – I always like to recount it. Dylan gave us a long question. We heckled him to no end for months. Chris Kelly then gave us a really long question months later. Johnny Num came in last episode with, I think it was last episode, with a 183-word submission. I think this isn't the 140s, but the 180s might have been our record.
And I'd like to give a very public apology to Dylan, because it was all in love, but we gave him a lot of juice, but then we got longer. Now we're getting much longer questions.
I feel like he inspired people, and that's when, and sometime after Chris Kelly, I decided to call some of these mailbag submissions.
Yes, he is the Mr. Holland's opus of long listener questions that have become mailbag questions.
Our mailbag is Dylan's opus.
Is it Patch Adams or Mr. Holland's opus where a woman goes to a guy's house and gets murdered?
Patch Adams. Oh. That was Monica Potter.
What?
The actress was Monica Potter. She was young then. Yeah, it was like 1996.
I remember watching that movie and go, did that just happen?
So much heart in that movie. Yeah, he was the really disturbed. I don't know if he was schizophrenic or what, but yeah.
I think Mr. Holland's opus had the actress from Uncle Buck.
Had Carol Kane? Wasn't that the wife?
Who was the younger woman that was very good in Mr. Holland's opus? She had curly hair. She was like Carrie Russell before Carrie Russell was Carrie Russell.
Oh, she played the character named Rowena. I can't think of the actress's name.
I feel like she was in Uncle Buck.
She might have been. Wait. She would have had to grown up a lot.
No, not the young one, the teenager. Because that's like an 8-year difference.
I guess so.
So if you're 17, 18 when you make that movie, you're 26 in Mr. Holland's opus.
Yep. That works.
I don't want to know the answer to this question. I just want to keep speculating.
I trust your math. I trust your math. I'm not here.
Wait, when was Uncle Buck made?
It was like 85.
It was after
88. 85, 88.
Yeah, I think it was 88 because Macaulay Culkin was in it. And a few years later, he was in Home Alone.
It was before Home Alone.
Which was 90 or 91. So it was probably 87, 88. When was Mr. Holland's opus made?
Like 94, 96-ish.
Oh, yeah. So it could be 8 years.
8, 9 years ago.
We saw Veteran.
All works. Folks, put away your abacus. Just trust us. You don't need an abacus for this. Put away your computer app.
They're driving right now with their cell phones, and they're just staring at it.
You ready for this Johnny Numb question? Am I reading this?
You're reading it.
All right, so Johnny Numb from, I believe, Harrodsburg, Pennsylvania, asks, and it's a doozy. Daniel Day-Lewis's announcement that Phantom Thread would be his final film got me thinking. For some reason, about MFF's frequent conversations about the thespian qualities of Vin Diesel and The Rock, which, again, for some reason, got this notion in my head. If Daniel Day-Lewis were to make one more movie co-starring Vin Diesel and The Rock, what would the character dynamics be and the plot be? Would it be Daniel Day-Lewis placed in an action landscape outside of his typical comfort zone, or would Vin Diesel and The Rock be pulled into a period art film? Would Day-Lewis be an ally to these muscle-bound action heroes, or would he be the Hans Gruber method actor villain? My inquiring mind wants to know. Seriously, it's been stuck in there for the past couple days and needed to get out. And by the way, Johnny's been very patient. He actually submitted this question months ago, and I've been sitting on it waiting for a good pod topic, and I figured this action movie was a good place to drop
So first I want to say Phantom Thread is amazing. It's a great film, and if you think it's just about a dude making clothes, a tailor, you're wrong, a dressmaker, because it's awesome, and it's warped, and it's beautiful, and it's Paul Thomas Anderson. Now, I'm pretending this is a world where The Rock and Vin Diesel actually share screen time, because if you watch The Fate of the Furious, they're never on screen together. And actually,
dude, it's like the Heat with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro.
Furious
never
7,
on screen together.
In one take. These guys don't like each other. So when they film, they're not together on screen. They're never together on screen because they don't like each other. But I'm pretending that this is a world that Daniel Day-Lewis would be in a movie with these two guys. So The Rock and Vin Diesel would never move over to the serious. They've tried it. Southland Tales, the other one with Vin Diesel where he tried to be a serious law or whatever. I don't know what it was. That didn't work. So what I'm thinking is this. Last Witch Hunter sequel, right? But it's a prequel. Now, Vin Diesel is the Last Witch Hunter. The Rock is the Wolfman, because Universal, before they scrapped their plans, wanted The Rock to be the Wolfman. So, the Last Witch Hunter teams up with The Rock's Wolfman character to battle an evil Van Helsing, played by
Van Helsing.
History says that Van Helsing was good. But what history doesn't know is that he was evil.
In a world where your favorite heroes are in fact evil, and all the monsters are good.
That's really good. So the bad guys are good, but Van Helsing was actually evil. He was evil trying to capture good people. It's like Sam Jackson trying to catch Hayden Christensen in Jumper. Now,
and so it makes sense that they team up, because Vin Diesel, being a witch hunter, he still uses spellcraft, and so he really is using some witchery, if you will.
But the problem is, he can use the witchery on witches, but then...
I just said witchery. I should probably have said witchcraft. I think I just made up a stupid word.
Daniel Day-Lewis has the secret amulet of around his neck, and so the Last Witch Hunter, his spells don't work, so he has to team up with the super strong The Rock, who becomes a Wolfman once a month. So you have a movie, right? You begin at the first of the month, right? So the full moon just happens. Then the movie starts with The Rock meeting Vin Diesel during a full moon. And they both kind of bump into each other, and they stop themselves from killing Van Helsing because they weren't working together. The following film has them working together. And by the next full moon, they team up to battle the in-character Daniel Day-Lewis, a.k.a. the evil Van Helsing. And he's in full Bill the Butcher mode. So he has two butcher knives in his hand, and he's beating the living snot out of Vin Diesel and The Rock. And the only way that they win is an invisible man played by, not Johnny Depp, because he was supposed to be the invisible man.
Not Jason Statham.
Played by Invisible Man, Jason Statham, who becomes
Kevin Bacon.
Hollow Man. Kevin Bacon shows up.
Yeah.
So they all team up, and they battle Daniel Day-Lewis. Doesn't that sound amazing?
I dig that. I like that. I also like that you went with the same thinking I did, which was Daniel Day-Lewis doesn't have to be a villain, but he's oh such a good villain. And I was thinking of him in Gangs of New York, and I was thinking like, well, they have like all the way planned through Fast 10, I think. So what if like in Fast 11 or 12, Daniel Day-Lewis is the villain?
I mean, they just had Helen Mirren. She's an Oscar winner. And, you know, Vin Diesel got Judi Dench to do Chronicles of Riddick 2.
Right. I mean, they could pull him out.
They get big.
They could pull him out of retirement. He could go a little bit Bill the Butcher and just be mean. I actually want to make him a South African warlord.
Actually.
Because then he could have the brutality of Bill the Butcher in modern day if you make him like an African warlord.
Charlize Theron is an Oscar winner, and she was in Fate of the Furious. So are you saying that Daniel Day-Lewis plays a South African drug lord with Chartel Copley as his right-hand man, and they battle the Furious crew?
This could happen.
And Jason
this could
Statham,
be a thing. Associate producers. We're associate producers if anyone uses this.
So Jason Statham, who murdered about a billion people in Furious 7, is now a full established good guy. And they...
He's Uncle Statham. Uncle Murder Statham.
He killed innocent cops. And then The Rock is like, well, you were in the service, so you're cool. He killed 40 cops. I'm going to count.
They weren't like shady
government operatives.
So the other side of this coin is that we do a period piece and we make Vin Diesel and The Rock Turkish oil wrestlers. You know what I'm talking about? Those Turkish oil wrestlers that are reaching each other's pants. But so they're Turkish oil wrestlers and they are entertaining like their emperor of the Ottoman Empire, and it's Daniel Day-Lewis. And maybe they like do the uprising to revolt against their emperor.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
They have to be on screen together a lot.
I was hoping that you were going to say that like The Rock and Vin Diesel were newsies and they have like those silly caps and they speak like chimney sweeps.
And they're singing like Christian Bale
and
Empire Day-Lewis of the Sun.
And Daniel Day-Lewis.
The newspaper company owner.
Vin Diesel's like, oi, where's our toupee?
He would not do that well.
And
I don't think The Rock has ever done an accent, and I think it's because he can't. I love The Rock, by the way. I want to think he can do anything, but he's never done an accent.
You know, The Rock. No, they've never done accents.
I think he's never done an accent.
And Be
Pretty
Cool.
Sure he's never done.
Are we talking about Vin Diesel or The Rock? I just got it. Oh, The Rock.
The Rock.
And Be Cool. Wasn't he trying to be a country singer?
Oh, you know, it's I haven't horrible. Seen that.
I've watched that movie, and.
But he was trying to do a country accent.
I watched this movie, and everybody there's a lot of people I liked in it, and I just sat there with my jaw open, just going, "What was happening with my life?"
Okay, an overseas accent, a foreign accent.
He couldn't do it. The Rock is The Rock.
It wouldn't. It's like it wouldn't.
Schwarzenegger pretty. Hasn't done an accent. Sly Stallone hasn't.
He just does his accent.
I think Bruce Willis has done accents, and the Jackal didn't.
The Jackal.
So at least he's tried. Keanu's done accents.
Whoa, like listen to how
hey,
British
we remember
I am.
Not to hate on that.
Listen
I know. To our Bram Stoker pod. It's been huge for us, actually. Great, great audience for it. All right, so let's move on to question 4. This is from Nick. Is Ben Mendelsohn the best working dirtbag today?
I had to check his IMDb because I haven't seen the majority of things he's done. I saw him in Bloodline. I saw him play his weird role in Mississippi Grind, Rogue One. Those are really like his villainous or dirtbaggy roles that I've seen. Now, that said, having not seen potentially quite a lot of them, he nails the shit out of it every time. But he's just a brilliant actor. He's a wonderful actor who has a look that I think is very conducive to being a likable schlub or just a rat.
I think he is the best dirtbag alive because there's many variations of his dirt baggery. You have Bloodline, but also Animal Kingdom, which I think is one of the 20 best 21st century films. I think it's.
And despite all the major actors,
it
in that,
is
I never saw it.
Unbelievable. And he steals every second that he's in it. There's a true menace to him, but there's no menace to him. That's how good he is. When he speaks in this movie, you're like, I'm afraid of this human being. Then he's in Rogue One, dirtbag. He's in Mississippi Grind. He's a lovable dirtbag. He's in Trespass. He out-dirtbags Nicolas Cage. He's going to be the upcoming dirtbag in Captain Marvel and Robin Hood. He is a fur jacket. Yep.
Ooh.
Yep.
New Robin Hood?
The kid from Kingsman. He is a fur jacket wearing dirtbag in Slow West. He is a dirtbag in the submarine thriller where Jude Law's a Russian, Black Sea. He is a awesome dirtbag in Killing Them Softly with Scoot McNairy. And if you watch that movie, just watch the first 30 minutes because they're amazing dirtbags. In The Place Beyond the Pines, dirtbag. In The Dark Knight Rises, he's a white-collar dirtbag. This guy, even in Ready Player One, he is a dirtbag. So he can be rich, poor, period piece, future. All of those combine to make him the perfect dirtbag. So I think Ben Mendelsohn is the best working dirtbag today. And you should watch Animal Kingdom because it's amazing.
I just haven't seen it. Like so many things, I just never got to. Most of the movies you mentioned that
so,
I haven't seen.
This is gonna, I shouldn't say. Whatever, I'll do it. I was working on The Odd Life of Timothy Green, and Joel Edgerton was on that movie. And this is when Jackie Weaver got nominated for an Academy Award for Animal Kingdom, and she lost. And I always stayed really professional when I was around them. You just do your job. You don't bother people. You're in different groups. Well, I saw him walking by one day, and it was like the day after Jackie Weaver lost, and I was almost like, dude, that was a robbery. Because but I didn't do it. But Animal Kingdom is an Oscar-nominated, very good movie, so I totally recommend it. And I don't know why I told that story, but it almost made me just embarrass myself professionally. Just
that movie's just stacked deeply with really great actors. Though. Yeah, Melissa Leo, right? And I haven't seen it. Melissa Leo, Joel Edgerton, Ben Mendelsohn. Yeah, there's more. Jackie Weaver. Who else?
Sullivan Stapleton, Joel Edgerton. I mean, just a loaded cast of dirtbags.
And who's Sullivan Stapleton?
He's a dude from Strike Back, and he's also in Blind Spot on TV, and he's in the much better sequel to 300, 300 Rise of an Empire.
I probably haven't seen this.
He's good. Like, everyone's good in it. And Ben Mendelsohn steals the show. And this is the first time I ever saw Ben Mendelsohn. And he scared the crap out of me. And you know how many movies I watch? Like, he's a legit threat. So you should definitely watch him in Animal Kingdom. All right, next question. Question 5 from Nick. Top 5 Spielberg movies. Can I read them to you?
You go nuts.
1 is Jaws. 2 is Raiders of the Lost Ark. 3 is Saving Private Ryan. 4 is Jurassic Park. 5 is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
We've got a lot of overlap. Yeah. So, I've got Jaws. I've got Jurassic Park. I have Temple of Doom. It was my first Indiana Jones movie, so it stuck with me a little differently. Catch Me If You Can.
I almost put that as 5.
It's a wonderful movie. And then even though he's not listed as the director, just about every analysis of the movie that you can ever find written or discussed orally, Poltergeist. Yeah. Tobe Hooper does horror great, but Tobe Hooper could not have made that kind of a heartfelt film. He was being puppeteered. So,
Jaws is my favorite movie, but I think the most wrenching film aside from Take Shelter that I've ever watched in my life is Saving Private Ryan.
It's rough.
So he gives Giovanni Ribisi a time to monologue about how he would pretend to be asleep while his mom watched him sleep, and all she wanted to do was talk to him. And he would just, and he's like, I don't know why I did remember. That. And then he dies the next day. And then you have a guy stabbing another guy in the heart while he's going, shh.
Whoa.
Yeah, Adam Goldberg stabbed in the heart and he's going, shh.
Yeah. That was
Barry
vicious.
Pepper gets blown up by a tank. And at the end, Edward Burns is like, you better be worth it. Tom Hanks dies.
But that's just the way it felt pretty real to me.
Yeah, that's my top 5. Back to Ready Player One. Want to get to the second key?
So there are so many things. Wait, we could talk about the second key. I do want us talking about Ben Mendelsohn, especially because we had a listener question about him. His character had a name that I keep forgetting.
Nolan Sorrento.
He is a delicious dirtbag in this. He's this corporate, slick, I don't know, the director of some kind of operations. I don't know if he's really a CEO. Did they say whatever? But he's clearly in charge of their field operations, if you will. And oh God, he's so cold. He's lying every chance he gets. He's a glib liar. Not as slick as he thinks he is, but he's a glib liar. And whenever he's on screen, you kind of not get scared, but you tighten up a little bit.
He has everyone dressing him like he doesn't dress himself.
Right. Yeah. His gear, his special suit for the game. And he'll even say, get this off. Like, it's not even that elaborate.
Yeah, you're right. He has people dress him.
And when he's in the game, and I felt that this both simultaneously worked and didn't work for different reasons, but in the game, his avatar is this, like, super buff, Superman. Like, circa 2010 yeah, Superman.
That's the way he sees himself. And I love it. And he has big teeth. Did he have some caps in this movie?
I don't know. But I agree though. He was very video game chic. His being big, it's like that's how it worked. It was very villain video
and
game
I think
chic.
Part of what made his character work so well is he obviously didn't get it. He's just a CEO. Like he's just a boss. Like he didn't get the true love behind any of it. He didn't get why people would want to win this game. He just wanted to win it. And he didn't care how.
Well, I think it's that he knows it, but he doesn't have the heart to feel it and get it.
He knows what coffee that Mark Rylance liked, because he was a former intern.
that was all right, that aspect of it. It wasn't necessary even, but, you know, it worked that he was an intern.
Better if he didn't, because then it's just some guy going, get me these keys.
Right, colder and more removed, yeah, like, But yeah, he was really cool, but you wanted to talk about getting into that second
shiny
key.
I thought that was a really cool set piece, and, you know, Spielberg directed AI, which was originally going to be directed by Stanley Kubrick, and this was just, was it in the book? It was just a love letter to Kubrick from Spielberg, which I think is amazing.
It was pretty neat, and when it first was brought upon us on screen, I was almost removing myself from the experience. I was almost saying, like, wait, what? The Shining? And even when H says, like, oh, yeah, I don't know. I don't watch scary movies. I don't know this one. They're like, oh, you don't know? And it created, like, this melody. I'm still thinking, like, this is not going to work. And even though I had convinced myself over the course of a minute or two that this will not work. And you know how damning that can be for your experience enjoying something when you do that actively. I still ended up loving it. I loved their execution of these aspects, the artistic license they took with weaving in the axe swinging, the grotesque woman you see in the mirror, just everything that they did. I thought it all worked really well. It did honor to The Shining without being too horror elemented, but having all the horror
elements.
Every
beat that you knew was going to happen happened, but you were still excited about it. You had the axe going through the door. You had the hedge maze. You had the blood. You had the person in the bathtub.
The parts that you saw coming, you were happy to see coming. And the parts that you didn't see coming were executed well.
What I like what Spielberg does really well is he blends practical with CGI really well. And I liked how, I don't know how CGI it all was, but I felt that some of it was built. Like, it felt grounded a little bit. It did.
When the blood came in?
Practical with CGI. And
I have a feeling that he was really releasing fluid into a three-dimensional
space.
He must have,
because it felt just visceral. And I really loved, like, that scene just takes you through the greatest hits of The Shining, but it makes you so happy. And, you know, we can be very jaded turds at times, but this whole scene had I had a smile on my face. I loved it.
And then they brought in something that clearly wasn't a part of The Shining in that Shining segment where there was the ballroom.
Oh yeah, the dance
with the zombie dancing.
Cool.
So like I didn't really love that. They acknowledged it had nothing to do with the movie per se. That was a weird scene for me. What worked for you in that?
I felt like there were actual, so a lot of movies they don't really have. I knew there were no stakes, but I felt like there were stakes in that moment. The way she was jumping through and what the chasm they were over and the humor that was had with her dancing with the zombies and the woman kind of calling for her to come to the character. I don't know. I was on the edge of my seat during it because it's weird. And I knew it wasn't part of The Shining, but I also enjoyed it. And even though it's a movie about avatars and an RPG, I don't know, it just seemed like there were stakes and it was a dangerous thing to be doing.
You know, I don't remember clearly. When we had seen the zombie dancing scene in The Shining segment, had we already seen the kind of nightclub scene where they were dancing in zero gravity? Okay, so we had already seen that. Okay, I just didn't remember. Like, where they had a zero consequence, you know, hovering dance scene, but then this is one where they could have potentially fallen to their zeroing out, respawning death.
Yeah, I don't know why. I just, even though I knew it was going to accomplish, I was like, And that's a true testament to the scene, because even though no one's going to die, they're just going to zero out. But I was still, I don't know, I liked it. I like zombies dancing. I like zombies waltzing. And I like the fact that she was dancing with zombies. And I thought the actress who was kind of like, hey, help me, did a good job. And I don't know. I liked the scene. I thought it was a good job.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they did zero out, there is some consequence, though. Because, I mean, Z has some stuff. He has his DeLorean. Later on, he buys the Zemeckis cube. He buys stuff. And they would be gone, and a lot of these things at some point matter. I don't know if he had the Zemeckis cube at that
point. No, he did, because he got the money from finishing the race.
Okay. So there was a lot of consequences.
And then he uses the Zemeckis cube to get the time back at the Zero Gravity Club.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, though, just coming back to the nature of the plot, none of this stuff really felt urgent to me, but it was okay that it didn't.
I like the scene where he got the second key. You want to talk about the third key?
Well, on his way to the third key, we see another horror element that I really liked. We see Jason briefly, right? We see Freddy just get blown to bits in a second and a half in the first, I don't know, 15 minutes of the movie. He disappeared real quickly. And then we have this. I like the horror elements peppered in here. The Shining, Chucky, Freddy, Jason. We're getting some classics.
So what happens is Sorrento finds this big orb. He's aided by T.J. Miller's I-Rock, he's my favorite character in this movie, T.J. Miller's I-Rock.
I really wish we saw him in the
real world. Of humor. And he understood it was a game the entire time, which is why I loved him. He's actually pretty smart with his tactics. But they unleash this cube of blah, 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 blah. They put a force field around this castle on planet Doom. And basically what happens is our homeboy Parsival has to lead an army. He does a big speech. All the people from the game come to get into this fortified castle, and they have to battle the IOI, bland gunmen. So you have all the IOI, who are basically like stormtroopers with their kind of stuff, battling Ninja Turtles, Battle Toads, Chucky, Freddy. I mean, everyone you can imagine. Iron Giant. Holy crap, that was so cool. All these cool characters are battling these kind of stock baddies. And he pulls Chucky out. Chucky tries to kill him. Chucky tries to kill the main character, and then he throws Chucky at the IOI gamers, and they just get wiped out by him. It was awesome.
Was Chucky an item? Okay, because I was thinking, like, he is really good at killing. Like, he dropped three people really fast with hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah, he was an item. And I just love that when he used them, Chucky tried to kill him. I thought that was so cool. And
you know, another item that was cool that was kind of like the Mechagodzilla that was mentioned earlier was when the Soul Calibur Samurai.
Dalto? Yeah, that's
it. The Soul Calibur Samurai. So he took his Gundam thing that he only had for 30 seconds to like hold off Mechagodzilla. That was actually one of the more urgent scenes for me. Because we knew he had a timeline, and we could see pretty quickly that he wasn't going to win this. He was just buying us time. It was kind of like when Iron Giant H, made a land bridge of himself.
Oh, yeah.
And then they were shooting off and then TJ Miller's, avatar was shooting off its fingers.
I don't even know about Gundam, and I was like, yeah! I love that scene. I love Mechagodzilla. I love that Iron Giant made itself a bridge. And when TJ Miller was shooting those fingers, oh yeah, you're right, I know I'm repeating you, but those scenes hit me hard when those fingers were getting shot. I'm like, don't kill the Iron Giant!
That was like the majority of the urgency of the film, though, was for me, was that stuff.
Yeah. I don't want to see the Iron Giant get hurt again.
Yeah, especially not by mean T.J. Miller.
I thought
he's shooting like a soul gun.
He was perfect in that role because he's obviously chilling at his house, but he knows he's in a game, but he knows he has a lot invested in the game. So
most of the people in the game who were like high level or named characters or really experienced characters were people who had like just played the crap out of the game and they had something to prove, right? And then you had like the rich guy who just bought everything and they buy all these things in the game. And, you know, so whatever, we can dismiss that. T.J. Miller was like, when games like EverQuest and World of Warcraft first came out, he was like the first guy to max out the levels that you can gain as a character. It's like he was the first guy. He was the first guy to be the most powerful in the game. But because a lot of people play the game, eventually other people reach that same power level because there's only so much you can do. But it's like he was the first dude sitting in his mom's basement to max out a level. Yeah. That's how I view him. That's why he is the way he is. He isn't excited like Z when he gets to buy this or do that. He's just like, yeah, this is a 99th level magic item, so it's going to take a magic spell to activate.
I don't feel like he even wants to win the game.
He wants more stuff, sort of, but he doesn't seem to covet it. He just wants some status. He wants a power that he can't get in the game, and I guess that is helping someone win everything, I guess. But yeah, it's like he can't be pleased.
I think his character was so invested in the game that he didn't want to risk anything to get himself killed.
Right, yeah, I mean, he was taking risks by being involved, but he usually had a pretty safe position.
Like, he was
position.
Not going to enter the races. He didn't care about The Shining. I just think he had a ton of stuff already. And he was like, you know, when you, like, I don't know, it's like you win $300 million in a lottery and you just want to chill for the rest of your life.
But you're that cool and you've earned all that stuff in the game, so you want the status of being the guy that someone comes to when they need help.
You know him in the game, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, he was cool. I liked him just being him, just being T.J. Miller. That was fun.
T.J. Miller being T.J. Miller is, I'm always good with. All right, so the big battle happens. And the whole point is for them to go to adventure and beat it. But then the whole point of them getting the third key is that you don't beat it. You just wander around.
Right, because that's how you found the first secretly hidden thing, which was the first Easter egg in any game in the history of games.
And I thought that was really cool. I thought that no one was really thinking about that. They just thought about beating it. And that's like another testament to Ben Mendelsohn's character. He'd never thought about enjoying it.
Yep. And our game creator, whose name escapes me.
He was Mark McRylance, Oscar-winning McRylance, whose character's name was Halliday.
Halliday, that's right. But like, and Halliday, while he created a way to beat the game, all of his ways to beat the game are anathema to one's thinking of beating a game. Going backwards in a race, looking for the Easter egg in the game that you find by doing nothing, that really didn't even reveal anything but the creator of the game on the screen, right? In the old game, it didn't even give you anything. It was just some random thing that happened as a glitch almost. And it's like, that's how you win. You don't win by beating that game.
I never even thought about that. It's kind of nice how go in reverse. Ask a person to dance. And then, you know,
that he was just afraid to do, yeah. And just everything was not your typical victory.
Jeez Louise.
It wasn't kissing the girl. It was just asking her to dance.
Jeez Louise. Good job, Spielberg.
It was all very sweet. This is why I say all the heart in this movie, in my opinion, or 95% of the heart that we see on screen, is from Halliday, our creator. And when they're in the archives, just seeing him reflect on making the game, and then they've made the game, and he's reflecting on his sentiments to not having a next step or a next financial venture for it when he's on screen with Simon Pegg, who's the kind of co-creator something or other. And just everything about him, he just wants it to be and to let people have it. And everyone's always pushing for something more. And when he gives you something more, it's not the way that anyone
and
would expect.
Moro kind of reminded me of Garth. Did he remind you of Garth from Wayne's World at all?
A little bit.
I don't know. I like Mark Rylance a lot. And don't know. What do you think about Artemis, Olivia Cooke? She's in a movie called Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, which I think she's amazing in. I heard she was really good in a film called Thoroughbreds. But I liked her. I thought she was one of the strongest actors in this movie.
Well, I thought she did a perfect serviceable job and that she wasn't handed a lot.
It was less about the acting and more about the...
I mean, the biggest drama that they cultivated was between Z and H, and H is saying, like, you don't even know to be a 300-pound man and not necessarily a girl that you think is cute. You don't even know who this is. They could be lying to you. They're just telling you what you want to... what you want to hear, you're just seeing what you want to see. And then she's even saying, you don't know what I'm like, this, that, and the other. But the fact is that that applies to everybody in the game. This is not a special thing. So when it's revealed, and first off, she's fine. There's nothing, she makes herself seem like she's a mutant or something. She has a birthmark
He does touch her head. But, like, remember she, like, kind of facepalms her prematurely? I'm like, that's a premature facepalm. But,
yeah.
But you know what I liked about...
The drama she was given
was
weak. You
know what I
liked
about Ty Sheridan, the Wade character? He fell in love with Artemis immediately. And that's like that's something an 18-year-old kid would do who is in a game. Like,
yeah,
so
I feel
when
that.
When he was doing that, I'm like, I buy it. Like, 18-year-old kid who doesn't really hang out in the real world. He's just in an online world. So I thought that was kind of... that didn't ring false to me. That seemed true.
Sure, yeah.
All right, so what else do we have in this movie that we can break down?
At the end of the day, I'm just coming back where I started. We've mentioned so many things that are littered down from film history over the last, basically since like 1975-ish, that we see on screen in this. And I mean, for me, that's the joy. I can't help but to wonder what the sentiment is for a 20 to 25 year old watching this movie.
That's what I was thinking, because the guy who wrote this obviously was enamored with 80s and 90s. But past that, there's really no 2000. I mean, well, there are video games. There's a lot of modern day video games in this.
Well, the whole video game in this is modeled after a more modernized version of our EverQuest, our World of Warcraft. I'm just picking the fantasy ones because they're the ones I know about. But you know, these games like this where you have your avatar, you act a lot. So it's using that as the medium. But all the things in it are not so mainstream. Even Freddy Krueger. The last Freddy movie was 2010. And don't get me wrong, as a horror fan, that's not long ago. But if you're in your 20s and this movie came out 8 years ago and that was a horrible remake, and before that, the last film was from the 2003, Freddy versus Jason, but that's 15 years ago. Like, do you really know Freddy, or do you just know that Freddy is someone who exists?
I think it's just he's someone who exists.
But so I gotta wonder, and Chucky, and all these things, and Mechagodzilla. When they say Mechagodzilla, I felt that. You gotta real like, does the average person who saw this movie know that Mechagodzilla was a thing? I mean,
yeah, that's right. I was wondering why there weren't more 2000s or now. Does
Gundam, for God's sakes, that's not a modern reference. You know what I mean?
This book was written in 2009? So obviously there were 2000 references. And I don't know, but I guess turtles are still really relevant.
And they made it look like the modern.
Mortal Kombat people still know about. But this,
because they made 10 of those games.
It's kind of interesting that the plot is teenagers, but it's meant for 30-year-olds.
35 or 40-year-olds.
Plus 30s. Yeah, you're right. 35 and up.
But yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. This was our movie. This was there for us. I'd love to hear how the younger demographic responded to this.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I guess Jurassic World, everyone knows King Kong. Because what, Kong part of, you know what, my first Kong movie was the Jeff Bridges Kong.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah, 1978
or
81.
76. And I think 76, yeah. And so I guess kids know Kong because of Kong Skull Island.
Right, yeah, there was that last year. Oh. There was the King Kong in 2006 or 7 as well.
And then Jurassic World had the T-Rex. That was massive.
There was Mighty Joe Young, that Disney live-action movie that was probably like 98-ish.
Bill Paxton, Charlize Theron. But, I mean, yeah. I don't know. So in the end of the day, I really enjoyed it. I don't think I gave it much thought, but I still feel like it's Spielberg light, but I enjoyed it. I would watch it again happily.
And for everything I've said, that I immediately afterwards apologized, saying, this isn't a negative criticism. Like, I'm going to buy this on 4K as soon as I can, as long as it's not ballooned in price.
And it's going to look great. Spielberg doesn't make garbage. He works with the best on the planet. So, no, I enjoyed it. I really liked it. Yeah, I mean, it's popcorn fare. I guess when I see a Spielberg movie, though, I always keep thinking it's more than popcorn, if that makes sense.
I feel like that would apply to almost every single one of his movies, yeah, except for this one. But this one, the reason this one is popcorn fare is because this one was just an amalgam of all things that he remembers or that are just iconographical in film in the last 25, 30 years. Like, I mean, I think that's why he was more concerned with doing honor to the nostalgia bomb.
Yeah.
Then he was a story. And again, you know what? For something that had such a basic story, I don't care. I don't care. Normally, that will take me out of some shit. I'll just be like, this story means nothing to me. None of it. They're like, we talked about the first race. We were analyzing the first race, sort of. It's like, those things could take me out of something. So none of that mattered to me.
You know,
none of it did. I really enjoyed this movie.
Kevin Smith was talking about Star Wars, and he was saying, I watch a Star Wars movie to get a certain feeling of watching a Star Wars movie. So even if there are flaws, if there are enough moments to make me go, whoa, like the Gorilla Walkers in Last Jedi in certain scenes, that's enough for him. And I feel like Ready Player One was enough for me as a nostalgia bomb.
So I watched this with my girlfriend, and at the end, we're talking about the movie. And the thing that I found myself saying more than once when we're just talking about the movie afterwards was, I just kept catching myself yelling at the screen, calling out the things I saw.
I do that too.
Oh my God, yeah. That's Battletoads. Oh my God, look, that's a Ninja Turtle. Holy shit, that's Chucky. Oh my God, Mechagodzilla. Yeah. Like, so much of the film, even if it wasn't always loud, was me pointing actively, like I had a physical reaction, pointing at the screen and calling out what I saw because I wanted her to know that it was there in case she missed it. Like, I was excited. Like, so that was a weird kind of fun. It's like going to a parade, with your family. Oh my God, did you see the giant floaty of Snoopy? Oh, did you see that person was dressed as this? Like, it was just a spectacle.
Megan hit me in the arm and went, that's Firefly. And I'm like, holy crap, that's Firefly.
Right. That's exactly that, though. That's the thing. Like, this is the hitting the person repeatedly in the arm next to you, saying the thing that you see that matters to you because you literally couldn't help yourself but to smack someone and say that thing that was in front of you out loud. You just word vomit it. And that was the fun of this movie. That it was such a different experience.
So at the end of the day, would you recommend it? Yeah, me too.
Oh yeah. Oh wait, especially if you're over 30. Particularly if you're over 30, over 35, absolutely go see it. Over 30, maybe. Over 25, I get a little dodgy. I don't know at that point. I need data from young people. Young people, if you listen to us, I don't know if we have older listeners or not. I'd love to know on Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Like, please tell us what you thought. Because I want to know what people under 30 thought of this. Did you not know what any of these characters were that I was screaming out loud and smacking someone next to me over? Did you just think, oh, look at that cool turtle person. Look at that cool toad person with shoulder pads. Look at that cool doll that's killing people. Like, what was your reaction?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend it. And also, let us know what you think about it. And John, do you want to do some?
So I've been a broken record for a lot of my plugging lately. I'm going to pump the brakes a little bit until we come back to horror. But I would like to point out, especially Johnny Num, albeit he part of a lot of horror movie websites like Loud Green Bird, Crash Palace, The Last Knock podcast. He continues to just bless us with wonderful questions and wonderful social media camaraderie. So this week, I'm just throwing out one. It's to Johnny Num.
And also, guys, please head to iTunes, rate, review, subscribe. We'd love to know what you hear. Let's build up those subscriptions. Also, thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoyed our Ready Player One pod. Next week, we're going to be talking about creature features. So if you have any creature feature questions, send them in. We'd love to talk to them. And so for me, Mark Hoffmeyer, and John Levengood, this is Movies, Films, and Flicks. We'll see you later.